One of the popular talking points right now in the UFO field, and one that's been highlighted by congressional staffers, is the possibility of the US government or some aspect of its defense infrastructure being in control of UFO retrieval and re-engineering programs. There's been rumors floating around that certain members of Congress are honing in on the private sector, looking for black budget special access programs that might be sequestering non-human technology, reverse engineering UFOs. And this isn't a new idea. The claim that this is taking place has been part of the UFO history since well around like the 1950s. And there's been a number of extremely credible individuals with backgrounds in the clandestine sciences, within the intelligence community, military servicemen of various ranks, who have bolstered this idea that someone somewhere within the labyrinth of silos and stovepipes that comprise the US military industrial complex has in their possession technologies, materials, biological samples that are not human and are far in advance of our own capabilities. Today, I'm joined by my friend Nick Cook, former CEO of the defense industry consultancy firm Dynamics and author of the internationally celebrated book, The Hunt for Zero Point. It's great to have you back on, Nick.
It's great to be back on. Thank you for having me.
So you started your journey into the UFO research field from the perspective of the black budget world of advanced and experimental aircraft. Do you want to give everyone listening some background about yourself and why this became a field of interest for you?
I joined a magazine called Jane's Defense Weekly in 1986. And I became the aerospace editor of JDW in 1987, which was a very interesting time in the aerospace world because it was a time when there were some very interesting and increasingly substantiated reports of strange dark shapes flying around the night skies of the desert southwest in America. Specifically, we knew that there was a stealth program out there. The Reagan era, which, as we all know, began in 1980, 81, was characterized by a period of very high defense spending, a ramp up in defense spending, and particularly in black world defense spending. The stealth era itself began under the previous administration, the Carter administration. There were some breakthroughs at Lockheed and other aerospace facilities into the whole science of stealth. In other words, making an aircraft, a platform, quotes, invisible. Of course, it's never actually invisible, but it certainly exhibits reduced signatures across a number of spectrums, including, of course, radar. And this breakthrough in radar stealth at the beginning, in the late 70s, early 1980s, was beginning to be seen, as I say, in these strange shapes that people were reporting that they saw in the desert southwest, particularly at night. And of course, this led to an increase in reports of UFOs. I mean, I wasn't even remotely focused at the time on UFOs. UFOs did not enter my sort of intellectual orbit at all at that time. But I was very interested in black programs because if you're a reporter on a pretty, it was an inside industry cutting edge journal, which Jane's Defense Weekly was, this was the hottest news of the time. And my colleague in the United States, a guy called Bill Sweetman, who has written extensively about black projects and stealth, we sort of began to work these things through together. He initially, and then I sort of tagged on behind to lend some weight to his efforts. He was based in the US. And Bill dug up some extraordinary stuff, initially about stealth platforms like the F-117 stealth fighter, which were sort of beginning to be spotted after they'd entered squadron service in 1983. And it remained secret, by the way, the stealth fighter until 1988 when it was revealed. So in that 5-year gap, They were seen, they were not understood, they were never photographed, or at least never photographed clearly. But we had this really good idea that there was a very, we were beginning to see the fruits of the Reagan era Black World defense spending. And so that's how I became involved in that particular aspect of reporting. And of course, little did I know that, you know, 20, 30, 40 years later, it was going to be reflected as well in the world of ufology, because these two things overlapped. It suited, as you know, and many of your viewers and listeners will know, it suited the world of counterintelligence to hide real-world defense programs behind the UFO smokescreen, and to flam that smokescreen up, to actually encourage reports of UFOs and flying saucers, because it was a, you know, a really good thing to hide secret projects behind. And so, just to set the scene, that was the era I found myself in. And when I became editor at the aerospace editor at JDW, and it became increasingly interesting throughout the late 80s and into the 1990s. That was sort of my background and induction into the world of secret projects.
And based on your research into these types of projects, how far in advance do you feel some of these highly classified programs within the black budget world are in terms of energy and propulsion systems and maybe weapon systems?
I think we really need to separate two things out here. One is there's a very well-advanced, what I would call conventional black world aerospace program using conventional technology, albeit on the exotic end of that spectrum. But, you know, utilizing aerodynamics, utilizing advanced forms of jet propulsion. So aircraft we'd recognize, except that they're very, they push the envelope in terms of performance, both in terms of speed and in terms of stealth, as I've mentioned, particularly important. And those were the two things, those two strands were the two technology strands that were being pursued in the 1980s and 1990s. Stealth, hiding your signatures, whether visual, radar, or infrared, and noise. And then hypersonics, moving incredibly fast, but powered by essentially conventional technology, although, as we may get into, the stuff that was being looked at hypersonically was really pushing the envelope again in terms of propulsion technology. The cutting edge at the time was something called a scramjet, a supersonic combustion ramjet, which was the thing, the propulsion source that would take a hypersonic aircraft out to its sort of Mach 5 to 8 design speed. So that's on one side. The other side were rumors of stuff that was truly exotic. Now, when I was, in terms of propulsion, when I was at Jane's Defense Weekly, I ignored that stuff. It's not easy to sort of remember now, but it's perhaps easier for me that when I started out in the 80s and 90s, if you breathed UFO or anti-gravity or anything like that in the circles that I was reporting on, you'd be out in your ear, and you wouldn't come back again. It was that taboo. So I, as I said to begin with, I ignored all of that stuff. There was enough to get my teeth into on the black world stealth hypersonic side of the spectrum. But in about 1990, when I'd begun to cover this secret world, particularly over in the US, I sort of set myself an exam question, and I probably, you and I have discussed this before, Jay, but, and I've certainly discussed it elsewhere. I sort of, the exam question for me was, okay, you've got this access to remarkable people in the defense and aerospace world. You're able to get into almost anywhere. I mean, even at that time into the Soviet Union, because by 1989, the wall had fallen and the Soviet Union was opening up its previously totally off limits aerospace industry. So we were even able to, to begin getting in there. Jane's had an incredibly good name in that industry. There were very few doors that were locked to me. And in that context, I thought, well, you've got this opportunity to really sort of push the, to really explore new ground. And what is the deepest, darkest technological secret you can think of, Nick? I asked myself. And I came to the conclusion that the thing that would probably be buried deepest, if it existed in the defense and aerospace world, would be a new propulsion source, a totally novel, exotic propulsion source, looking nothing like jet technology at all. It would look like a UFO. I mean, whatever came out of that enterprise would look like a UFO, and it would be powered by some kind of anti-gravity device. So with that in mind, I set off on a journey. It was triggered by various things, which I subsequently came to write about in the book that I'm probably, best known for in the ufology field, even though it's not a UFO book, called The Hunt for Zero Point. And that was a hunt to find this exotic energy source if it had been buried in the black world in the United States. And I go off on the journey and, I think you've read the book. You know that it's sort of, it's told in a quasi thrillerish vein, but it essentially ends with a question mark. I see loads of really, really good, strong circumstantial evidence that a program existed and was existing at the time I was doing my study. But I never came to any kind of smoking gun evidence that proved that it did. But there was plenty that it was interested and had been interested in it for a very long time. And I make no bones at the end of the book that, this has been a fascinating journey. It's taken me 10 years, but I wish I could say that I found definitive smoking gun evidence of a buried anti-gravity program within the US aerospace industry, but I didn't. And I sort of left it then. The book came out in 2001, and I then just moved on to other stuff. You mentioned Dynamics, which was an enterprise that I got involved in after I left Jane's in about 2005-06, which was to work with the 9 aerospace and defense technology primes to extract technologies that could go to acting on global challenges like climate change and food and water security and stuff like that. So I kind of left it all behind, and I'd completely sort of given that world up until, of course, that seminal date in all of our calendars, which was, I think it was December the 16th, 2017, when the New York Times came out with its story about ATIP, a buried UFO investigation program within the Pentagon. It also detailed those sightings of Tic Tac and other UFOs by US Navy pilots. And actually, I thought, well, what's good enough for the Pentagon, what's good enough for the US Navy and the New York Times in terms of talking about this stuff? That sort of rekindled my interest. And I sort of got back involved in interest terms in the whole exotic aerospace platform story. And I felt that I probably had some new insights to bring because I brought with me those black world investigation activities of the 80s and the 90s. But I have to say, and of course, it doesn't I don't need to point this out to you or anyone who's watching, that the last 5 years have just been completely extraordinary in the revelation upon revelation that has pointed to an exotic, ill-understood, if not completely misunderstood phenomenon, but which at its core holds the prospect of some form of or forms of flying vehicles, UFOs, that maybe some of them may be built terrestrially, but I think the evidence increasingly is telling us that this phenomenon is multifaceted, and at least some of those facets are based on a technology or technologies that do not come from this neck of the woods. Or if they do come from this neck of the woods, they are not what we would customarily think of as being terrestrially developed. And that's where we are today.
Yeah, like you said, there's been a phenomenal shift in the discussion over the last few years. I remember when that New York Times article came out and the media started reporting on this, it was good to see the media reporting, and you were seeing mainstream media anchors discussing it, but there was still the X-Files music. There was still the, you know, kind of little green men and poking fun at it. You don't see that so much now. That seems to have been thrown away from the way in which it's being addressed by the mainstream, which is a good thing. It's encouraging because they're taking it seriously, and it should be taken seriously because this is absolutely a real situation. And whether or not the US government's going to be entirely transparent, I very much doubt they're going to be entirely transparent on what they know. But what do you, how do you sense this unraveling as you've seen it so far from 2017 with the New York Times to where we're at right now? In the short term and maybe in the long term, what do you see occurring?
Well, I completely agree with your characterization of how it is being received or beginning to be. It's interesting that it is being received much better in the States than it is here in the UK. And whilst, the sort of, for the most part, the sort of X-Files music has been dropped from mainstream media coverage of the subject. I mean, particularly in the States. In the States, it's very gratifying to see how that media story is playing out. In the UK, it's just largely being ignored.
Nothing really.
You know, largely being ignored, which on the one hand is incredibly frustrating because it is... you know, as we've discussed before and with colleagues, it's probably the biggest story that there is or could possibly be in our generation and you know, any generation that I can conceive of coming down the track for a few hundred years. But having said that, I get it. You know, I'm a former journalist. I understand why there is a reluctance to cover this stuff. You know, I'm sort of particularly frustrated that my former colleagues in the defense and aerospace media don't embrace it more. They're beginning to, but they don't embrace it more. But, it, you know, we shouldn't, I think, be too quick to berate these guys because they are wrestling with a taboo. You know, that taboo is still out there. And I think the good thing, the thing that has flipped, is that the whole debunker community, there are still some out there, of course there are, but the debunker community, they look like the ostracized ones now, not the the sensible core of people who are reporting on the UAP UFO question. That is a great shift, in my opinion. And, you know, it's long been a... mantra of mine that you can take any data point you want if you want to debunk a subject, any subject, and you can take that data point and using clever words, intellectual arguments, other data, you can crush it if that's what you want to do. What it is very hard to do in this subject is debunk the entire canon of the story from beginning to end. If you look at the story from its inceptions, and God knows when they are, but if you take just a point in time like 1947, which is, you know, we accept as sort of the beginning of the modern era of UFO UAP sightings, and you take it up to the present day, it is incredibly hard to just kill that through debunking, because the testimony is there, and amongst the testimony is there amongst super credentialed witnesses of the kind that I would refer to when I was a defense reporter. You know, I would go to those people and use them as my sources to stand up stories that are very firmly rooted in our real world.
Can you hear me?
Yeah.
All right, there we go. Weird. I don't know what happened there. Just disconnected the mic. What was I saying? Right. Yeah. So, well, the thing is, you know that these debunkers, if the US Navy pilots or anyone else of that kind of background was actually on their side with it, they'd be using them as examples. So, I mean, it's a confirmation bias. You know, they'll take anything they can to prove the point. And obviously, there are going to be misidentifications and fakes and all sorts of stuff distributed online, eventually making its way online, that it's very hard to sift through a lot of the material and come to a good understanding. But when you do have examples like obviously the template that's being provided to us by the US government and its infrastructure through the whole Nimitz and you know, the US Navy pilots and the Tic Tac, you know, this is all quite a nicely packaged way of explaining, look, we have sensor data, we have eyes on data from you know, very highly trained weapons specialists and observers, we've got the Aegis radar system, we've got this, that, and the other. It's very strange that people would even think that that could be debunked, in all honesty, because it's quite an apparent case of something going on. But like you said, you examine the historical record, and there's no way you can just throw the entire thing out into the bin. It makes no sense to do that.
No, none at all. So, you know, what are we dealing with? We're dealing with human nature. You know, there are always going to be people who, for whatever reason, want to stand outside the crowd. And I never thought I'd hear myself say that, because the crowd we're talking about is a cadre of people who accept, sensible people, who accept that the evidence for this phenomenon is now overwhelming. Mm-hmm. The key question, of course, is, and this was brought up in the Pentagon and defense intelligence report last June, is what is the composition of the phenomenon? And of course, it lists the silos and the buckets within which the possibilities fall. And they are, you know, our own technology, in other words, America's own Black World technology, other technology in the form of a nation states like Russia, adversary states like Russia or China. And then you sort of start getting into misidentifications, and then you get into finally the exotic stuff, you know, which is the stuff that everyone's interested in. The bit that interested me in that report, I mean, a lot of it interested me, and, you know, we don't need to go back over it in terms of its significance for me being not so much what was in it, it was relatively anodyne, but the admission that there is a real phenomenon and that UFOs are real, even if they, the defense and intelligence community of the US, don't know what they are. And we can discuss that too. But, you know, within that, the way in which it's not ours was dismissed so readily at the beginning of the report was very interesting. You know, harking back to where we started this conversation, the United States has a long history of secret technology development. I know I shared with you in the last 24 hours or so, an article that I'd found while I was clearing out some stuff here at home that I'd written in JDW, James Defence Weekly, in 1996, when I'd been on a tour of America's secret project developments organizations within industry. Northrop's, Lockheed's, Martin Marietta's, as it had recently been merged into Lockheed Martin, and one or two others. From just rereading that article and refreshing my memory of the people I'd spoken to, one of whom was the boss of the Skunk Works, the Lockheed Martin Skunk Works, a guy called Jack Gordon. I sat down with him inside the Skunk Works, which had never happened before, to my knowledge, or at least not for a very long time. And we talked about some of the programs that he was working on. He said, in my time as a Skunk Works employee, I've worked on 15 real flying aircraft programs, but I can only talk about 12 of them. So some of those programs may have come to light, but the weird thing, or it's not that weird actually, but it's the thing that we should remember, is that a lot of those programs from the 80s and the 90s have still not been revealed. They are as hidden away then, and those three missing ones from the Lockheed Martin Skunk Works were, that's just them. And those are only the ones that he's admitting to. There are bound to be many others that he's not even going to admit to in a million years. But you know, that's reflected, or was reflected, across the other aerospace corporations of the day. There's all kinds of stuff that is still buried away, hidden. And you know, people ask me, when do you think they will be revealed? I think a lot of them will never be revealed, not just because they are technologically advanced, but because they're embarrassing. They were built under a regime that is very necessary, necessary to the Pentagon. And I wouldn't dispute that. I mean, you need to keep highly advanced technology secret from your adversaries. So there's a very clear need for special projects departments in these aerospace corporations that are rigorously secure. But of course, where it starts to get a little edgy and blurred is in the way those projects are funded. You know, a black project by its very nature has money squirreled into it that is unaccountable. I think in this day and age, that's not very healthy for democracy, actually, to have that level of financial opaqueness about government business. So, but in terms of the programs themselves, there are just reams of them that have never seen the light of day. And I just don't think will, because the embarrassment factor is reflected on government officials of the day who denied that these programs existed till the cows came home. And these people, or many of them, are still alive and would be massively embarrassed by, you know, I mean, in my day at James, the big story after the initial stealth revolution was a very high flying, putative Mark 5 to Mark 8 reconnaissance aircraft to replace the Lockheed SR-71 Blackbird called Aurora. It was like chasing a ghost. This thing, I honestly believe existed. It was recorded in a very sort of oblique way in Pentagon documents, but no one ever saw it. I mean, no one ever saw it to photograph it, clearly. And it took on the properties of a genuine bona fide UFO. If that project was funded and funded in secret to the tune of billions of dollars, because it would have had to have, it would have required billions of dollars to achieve those hypersonic breakthroughs. That's embarrassing, because it's been denied by government officials, or certainly was denied during the 80s and 90s. to a press that had wised up after the stealth obfuscations of the previous decade and knew how to ask their questions. We knew how to ask questions that it was very difficult for government ministers and officials to wriggle out of. But they did, because as you know, Jay, under special access program rules, you are allowed to dissemble, misinform, disinform, and lie outright to protect the core secret. And that was the order of the day then, and it's the order of the day now. And that is embarrassing. And people don't want to talk about it, which is why I think many of those projects, if not 99% of them, are never going to see the light of day.
Do you think that some of these black projects that are trying to avoid, obviously, audits and too much oversight might be using illegal funding mechanisms like the drug trade, the arms trade, human trafficking, things like this?
Well, it's funny you should mention it. I was watching last night a program on an HBO documentary. I don't know if you've seen it, called The Invisible Pilot.
No.
And it's about a guy. It's an extraordinary story. He was a crop dusting pilot from Arkansas who faked his own death in 1977 and ended up running drugs for the CIA during the the Latin American Nicaraguan Contra wars.
Is this Barry Seal?
No, funnily enough, it's not Barry Seal.
It's another guy.
And Barry Seal's an ex-airline pilot, I think, he did the same thing. Those forms of funding for those sorts of projects, and in this case, you know, we're talking about the Iran-Contra scandal. So, you know, money from weapons was diverted into the drugs trade, and then the drugs were brought into America, for heaven's sake, and that's not deemed to be wrong. I mean, how has that had that not got out of control? Do I think those sorts of mechanisms were used for funding black technology projects? I don't think so. I mean, they might have been. I think those sorts of funding arrangements were for much dirtier programs. I mean, dirtier in the sense of those, you know, arms running, drugs running sorts of activities. But who knows? You know, that's the thing. You can't ever be sure. But no, I think more standard obfuscation techniques were used for black programs and still are. I mean, when you have a defense budget that is close to $1 trillion annually in the States, it's not too hard to salt a lot of that away into secret projects. So that's been going on for an awful long time.
Well, a lot of academics within physics and engineering would argue that exotic systems that utilize like anti-gravity, electrogravitics, zero-point field, polarizing space-time with generated gravity or any of these types of things, that they're far-out theoretical concepts that require a level of energy generation that we're not capable of achieving. So if there have been genuine breakthroughs with disruptive energy and propulsion systems that are beyond next generation in their capabilities, how exactly have these groups prevented the wider scientific community across the world from making these discoveries for themselves? Is it simply the fact that they have in their possession alien technological artifacts which have provided them with an innovative edge that the wider scientific community hasn't got? Or has there been active engagement from this kind of intelligence defense group within the military over time that's been silencing, bribing, maybe hiring, perhaps even killing, if necessary, people in the open scientific community who have made these discoveries over time? So to simplify the question, in your opinion, why is this type of breakthrough technology not being created openly somewhere in the world?
Well, I'm very agnostic on the premise of that question to begin with, which is whether a breakthrough has been achieved. As I mentioned a short while ago, when I did that inquiry, and it took me 10 years to do the kind of basic research for my book, The Hunt for Zero Point, which examined that very question, I came to the end of it as I said, with no firm conclusions. Plenty of circumstantial evidence, no firm conclusions that a program existed in the year 2000 or by the year 2000. I'm much more agnostic on that now. You know, previously I'd sort of said, I don't think they've cracked it. You know, when people ask me at the time, okay, you don't make the definitive statement in the book, but what do you really think? And I would say in the year 2001, 2002, when the book came out here and in the States, I don't think they cracked it. I think it's too big a problem. The physics is too out there. Don't think they did it. I'm much more agnostic on it now. I'm not saying that they have, but I think that it's possible to divide the discussion up into two essential buckets. One is, has there been a terrestrial breakthrough of, within the aerospace defense sector of the United States that has led to a kind of, you know, a terrestrial anti-gravity type vehicle? Don't know, but it could be, is what I think. Then have there been crash retrieval programs of exotic extraterrestrial type vehicles, which have been back engineered, re-engineered, and reflown? I seriously doubt whether that is the case, but I do think that there is enough evidence amongst, you know, dug up amongst people that you've had on your show and have appeared on others, to suggest that the crash retrieval program itself is pretty well founded. I think there is pretty solid evidence, circumstantial and some tangible, in the sense of some materials left over that point to crashes and retrievals having taken place. But I think getting that stuff to work, from what I've gleaned from people I've spoken to who should know, or perhaps know people who should know, is that that is and has been a phenomenal challenge and has not led to breakthrough. But the wholly terrestrial developed technology developed within the halls of, you know, the Lockheed Martins of this world, the Northrop Grummans, the Boeings, whoever, I think there is better. I feel more reassured now that something like that may have happened. And that is part of what we're seeing out there.
One thing that that people bring up, and rightfully so, is that if these UFOs are so highly advanced, why are they even crashing in the first place? You know, why have there been so many reported crashes and subsequent recoveries of UFOs? And one of my go-to proposals is that they're in fact not crashing, but maybe dropping these craft on our planet on purpose, like a kind of technological trail of breadcrumbs with the intention of maybe guiding us in a certain way. And then you have the idea, obviously, that there's highly advanced weapon systems that have been developed that can incapacitate the propulsion systems of these craft, that we have developed these kind of systems in secret and have been disengaging these UFOs to retrieve them and study them. So why do you think there have been so many purported crashes of advanced aerospace vehicles?
Well, we're sort of we're veering into the other half of my professional life, I suppose, now, in that more recently I have become quite engaged in the study of consciousness. What on earth, I hear you saying, has consciousness got to do with ET crashed vehicles in, you know, remote parts of the US desert Southwest? Well, the high strangeness that surrounds all of that side of things is so strange that we have to begin, I think, looking at alternate explanations for what this technology represents. To me, and I think you were hinting at it as well, there is a very large degree of symbolism in them. You know, they're not, these things And this is where people really and rightly start to question me about, you know, how can this be? Because what these craft exhibit, to my mind, are both physical and non-physical properties by our standards. So we are judging their physicality against a baseline, an interface of our 3D/4D world, our three-dimensional, four-dimensional world. We think of that world, this world, as being physically, solidly real. You know, I bang my desk, it's solid. But when we get into, and I'm not a physicist, but I speak to plenty of people who are, when we get into the physics of the atom and the subatom, you know, the particle physics, we learn that, you know, an atom is 99.99999% empty space. But actually, even that's not true, because there is no such thing as empty space. If you believe in fleeting particles entering and leaving our reality, you know, under so-called, you know, around their 0-point baselines. But that's kind of another story. But, you know, if our physical reality based on the atom is actually premised around something which is 99.99999% non-physical, then why are we so sure that our physical world is as solid as we perceive it to be? And it was really that question that made me want to investigate the whole UAP UFO field from the other direction completely. I'd come from the nuts and bolts side of James Defense Weekly. I'd investigated black programs and had a great time doing that. I'd noticed that, you know, many other highly respected and respectable UFO researchers had devoted their entire lives to pursuing the question of what these things are. And most of them veered towards the nuts and bolts solution. At least they did sort of up to about, I don't know, 5 or 10 years ago. There are exceptions, and, you know, we all are familiar with the name of Jacques Vallée. And I think Vallée's work was tremendously pioneering in exploring the idea that there is a non-physicality to UFOs.
We had a couple of technical difficulties, so apologize for that. We just had to sort the microphones out. But yeah, you were talking about Jacques Vallée because you were talking about how we need to incorporate a wider kind of perspective on the phenomenon, that it's not just nuts and bolts, that it is a consciousness component, and that there are some very credible, well-researched people like Jacques Vallée who have been in this for a long time, who believe that this is a vital aspect of the conversation.
Absolutely, and I agree with that. And so when I began to sort of come to the conclusion that so many people had devoted really good study to UFOs, and except for Jacques and a few others, were coming to the conclusion that this still was a nuts and bolts phenomenon, I thought, I'm never going to be able to make a dent on that side of things. I need to come into this if I'm going to re-enter the field at all. And this was after the whole New York Times story in 2017 emerged. If I'm going to re-enter this as someone who's curious and wants to make some inroads into what I think or what may be going on, I'm not going to make any headway from the technology direction anymore. I need to come at it from the Vallée consciousness direction to see what gives there. And that meant totally re-educating myself. I was helped by the fact that my wife had the most extraordinary shared death experience when her mum died, which transported her off to a place that most people talk about in near-death experiences, you know, into a realm, she said, that was more real than real, It was almost identical to what NDEers say they experience when they, quotes, die and are brought back from the dead. And I was so impressed by this. This is my wife. We've been married a very long time. She doesn't make things up. This had to be real, but I didn't know what it was. So I began to investigate it. So I was led to it sort of naturally. This was in, I think, 2014. So some years before the New York Times story emerged, but it got me into the whole consciousness field. I read and read and read on it. I then became so interested that I wrote a novel about it called The Grid. It was a thriller. By the end of when that had come out, I was still so interested in it that I thought, I want to continue researching consciousness. But, you know, there are cooks in the family to feed, and that wasn't going to be so easy. But in the extraordinary way that things work out in this whole field, once you get involved in the consciousness arena and synchronicities emerge, a benefactor, a philanthropist, steps out of the void and we meet. He'd read The Hunt for Zero Point, really liked it, and said, what are you interested in now? And how can I help you on that journey? And I told, well, actually, he'd sort of guessed anyway that I was heading down this consciousness road. And so I was funded by a philanthropic grant for a year and a half, maybe 2 years, to go and study consciousness. It was like, you know, I think I said in my note to you beforehand, it was like bootstrapping myself mm-hmm. into a degree course on consciousness. And I emerged from that with a whole bunch of data. My philanthropic friend said, there's no deliverables on this. I just want you to come and meet up with me from time to time and explain what you found, which I did. But at the end of it, I'm sort of left going, well, now what? You know, I've got all of this data. What do I do with it? And then lo and behold, Mr. Robert Bigelow, famous for his investigations of UFOs and other stuff we can talk about, he launches a competition called, as part of an initiative to launch a new consciousness institute called BICS, the Bigelow Institute for Consciousness Studies, he launched an essay competition which asked the question, what is the best evidence for proof of the survival of consciousness after bodily death? And I thought, well, actually, I think I've got enough data to be able to have a go at that. So I enter the competition, and I'm one of the 29 people who are selected as winners and runners up. So, and actually that's sort of launched a whole new aspect of what I do, in that then shortly afterwards, it was actually the beginning of this year, Robert Bigelow asked me whether I would like to be a research director of BICS, this new institute, which I accepted along with several other contest winners.
It's amazing how things fall into place, isn't it, Nick?
Well, it is. I mean, it really is extraordinary, and particularly when you set an intention.
Yeah.
Because I'd set the intention not thinking for a second, really, that it was going to... Well, actually, it's not entirely true. I set the intention knowing that when you set an intention, it works. But at the time I set the intention, which was for me to be able to work with some of the world's leading consciousness researchers, I had no means of achieving that, mm-hmm. making that happen. There was no one in my world at the time who could nudge me in that direction. But within a year and a half, here I was. To your point, it is incredible how these things fall into place, particularly when you set an intention.
Yeah, same things happened to me, man. Same things happened to me and continue to be. I continue to be shocked and surprised by life, honestly. You know,
well,
and
maintaining a positive outlook is all part of that. And It's a thing.
It is. It's a very important thing. And when we were speaking recently, I'd asked you if you'd given any more thought towards making attempts at initiating a form of contact through the kind of practices that people would recognize as CE5, but in basic terms, it means to get into a peaceful meditative state and coherently project your intentions for making peaceful contact out into reality, the intention of making contact with something that is on the same wavelength or higher, that you can that they can hear your thoughts and that they can hear your intentions. And I recently did a presentation where I did my best to break down some of the very woo-woo sounding ideas and provide a kind of like a rough explanatory framework for why I think this is possible on a physics level, and why this is something I think most of us, if not all of us, are capable of in some shape or form. But I asked you if you were thinking of doing this yourself, and you've decided it's not for you. Would you be able to tell us why you feel that way?
What am I? I guess probably at heart I'm a storyteller, is what I am. But I've come from an investigative journalistic background. That's how I started. When I was very young, when I was a kid, I always wanted to be a pilot. I wanted to fly. And then when I have eyesight issues, so that wasn't really going to happen in terms of military flying. So when I joined Jane's, I was able to do several flights in fast jets. That was as far as I ever wanted to take it. I got my kicks by flying in Tornados and Phantoms. I did it a couple of times, and then I thought, actually, it's fine being where I am, which is not being part of that community, because I can use my objectivity to report on it. I think more, I say accurately, that's not entirely true, but to use the
Without
word
being
again, more objectively.
tainted by bias or anything like that,
Yeah, exactly. I could be just that one step removed and back from it and observe. And that's the same thing with this, to be honest, Jay. We've talked about your experiences before. I watched your excellent presentation on orbs and contacting, the sort of the CE5 sort of contact protocol, and I have no doubt that it exists. But I don't feel a need to engage at that level with it. I do entirely share your view, as you expressed in your presentation, that you need to set a very positive mindset to do this. There are too many tales out there of people who've had unfortunate experiences, and I think it's because that whatever's been going on in their lives at the time has not been a good reflection, or it hasn't reflected well out into that interface, that thing that we were beginning to describe a few moments ago about the interface between 3D, our 3D, 4D world, and the deeper realms, chances are, from which these things appear. But the approach that you've taken with that positive mindset, I think overcomes that. And I'm just very happy to sit back and report on other people's experiences, but people whom I trust. And there are plenty of witness accounts and statements out there. I read them every day from people who have these experiences. And there is no doubt that it is a phenomenon.
Yeah, I think I completely understand where you're coming from in that regard, because I actually feel relatively similar. I've had my experiences and they were profoundly life-changing. And to be fair, I am actually still going out on a warm summer evening right now, especially because it's so nice and clear and warm and sitting out and starting to do this again. But to a certain extent, I actually feel, satisfied with what I saw. And it confirmed to me that this is very much a real thing and it needs to be looked at. I do think we need to be extremely aware of the fact that reality is too large for us to comprehend. And so for us to imagine there's nothing but positive, benevolent intelligences out there in the wider cosmos is pretty naive, to say nothing of the potentiality of there being denser or less dense dimensional realms of existence. And if these types of realms exist, then perhaps there are things that people construe as devils, demons, poltergeists, alien abductors. Maybe that's where these things come from. So I think whilst we remain ignorant to the wider dimensional and experiential landscapes that reality has to offer, we should maintain a level of caution when engaging in practices that would appear to in some way allow your awareness to traverse space and time, perhaps even traverse dimensional space outside of our linear cosmos. And so if that is what is going on when you're getting into these highly resonant states and you're projecting your intentions, you definitely want to be operating on the highest level of positive resonance available to you in your emotional toolkit, because you would imagine that there is a genuine risk potential involved when you're projecting your own coherent signal out into reality. But I also have to pay attention to my own synchronistic path, and my own path tells me deep down in my intuition, at a level that I don't feel like I can ignore, that when you ground yourself in the highest possible states, which are states of love, your energetic signature is not compatible with a lower, denser, vibrationally inferior expression of intelligence. It can't perceive you in that state. You're perceivable only to that which is of an equal or higher level of conscious sophistication. This is just intuitive knowledge. I don't expect anyone to believe me on that, but that's how I feel about it. And I've been feeling like I've been drawn more towards respecting that as I've been. Sorry, I've got people like screaming outside. I don't know if you can hear that. Can you?
That's good.
All right. Well, I apologize because I can hear my neighbors yelling at each other. As long as no one else can hear it, that's all good. But yeah, this is what I've been drawn to. My own life and my own experiences, culminating up to me actually coming into the UFO research field, have all served as hints that this is the direction that I want to go in with this type of research. And I'm always open to being wrong, and I'm never very solid in my belief structure around these kind of things because there's just too much to try and deal with. But at the same time, there are certain things that have happened in my life in conjunction with coming into this research field and having these experiences with the phenomenon through the methods that I had them in, that just made me think that there's something else going on here that's benevolent and actually wants to assist in some way expanding the human mind.
Well, we have to get to grips with this. I mean, in terms of understanding who we are. I was watching a presentation a few days ago, I can't remember whose it was, but they talk about moving towards a singularity. A singularity that is based on technology, on science, and on us. We are that convergence point is coming, where the pace of technological development is, as we all know, that curve is extremely steep at the moment. Science is an interesting one because science is making extraordinary discoveries daily, but yet is institutionally stuck on some very big questions. We have the dark matter, dark energy fudge. These are adjustments that have to be made because the accelerating, expanding universe is not understood, and we're left with only 5% of the universe that we can point to as identifiable, and that's solid matter. And sciences, for the most part, mainly its refusal to engage in the consciousness question to the degree that, the flip, I think, is coming. The flip being, at the moment, we live in a materialist, reductionist scientific world where matter is primary and consciousness is secondary. To wit, if you equate that to the brain, we derive our consciousness from electrochemical reactions that are going on inside our heads. The consciousness proponents would want us to flip that on its head, in that matter is derived, the world of matter, the world of everything is derived from consciousness. And that's very hard to get one's head around. But the way that I began to get my head around it was through a very useful analogy that a professor of cognitive sciences at the University of California, Irvine, a guy by the name of Donald Hoffman, presents us with an analogy. And that analogy is this computer screen. On your computer screen, I don't need to understand what's going on from a software and hardware point of view to work it. I work the screen and what I want to do through the apps that are on the screen. So too with reality, he says. We have relationships with icons, and there are an infinite number of icons, mm-hmm. and we forge those relationships, and somehow they bind themselves into a kind of consensus reality. But behind the screen is all of that software and that hardware of deeper realities that we never get to experience, because evolution or something has hardwired us only to accept the reality we need for survival, no more. So what lies behind the screen? You know, I think the malleability of the screen is showing itself right now to be even more malleable than usual. And, you know, that singularity that guy spoke of in his presentation that I saw a few days ago seems to be coming to that apex. There is so much more, you know, weird stuff out there that's happening. And it is only accelerating when our institutions, like the US Navy, like the Pentagon, like NASA, of course, mm-hmm. acknowledge the reality, quotes, of the UAP issue, which they have done. So this whole thing, I think, is in a sort of feedback loop. The more they acknowledge that there's something going on they don't understand, the more malleable the screen becomes, and the more stuff that we would customarily not recognize as physically real comes through the screen and appears to us. And, you know, we appear to be in that era right now, mm-hmm. Which makes life quite interesting.
Well, you know, people are translating this in all sorts of ways, you know, the age of Aquarius and the awakening of humanity into a new age of consciousness and things like that. You know, this is the kind of rhetoric that's been spoken out for many years in terms of where we're going as a human species. And it makes me think of Terence McKenna. I don't know if it was necessarily him that you were listening to, but his whole spiel about a singularity at the end of time, and that there is a, you know, almost like an attractor, like there's a basin of attraction that we're circling around through evolutionary cosmic time, and that we're getting closer and closer to this point where all things connect and all things converge. And the closer you get to that thing, the weirder things become, because everything's pouring out of this one kind of singularity moment, and you're getting closer around the event horizon of this strange basin of attraction. That's been his whole idea, was that we aren't being pushed by evolution, but we're being pulled by a force at the end of all history, and that this whole journey is a journey through history, and that when the singularity is upon us, it will be the end of all human history, and all things will be converging at the same time. So who knows if that's really what the message of the UFOs is, as some sort of sign or symbol of us approaching some inevitability, some single track, as if we're being channeled through evolutionary walls towards something that we can't avoid. Who knows if that's what's happening, but things are certainly getting more bizarre, and that can't be dismissed.
It can't. And you know, you touched on an interesting issue there, which is why are we seeing what feels like an increase in the number of sightings of UFOs, UAP. And what does that represent? If we go back to that computer screen analogy with those icons, you know, those are what I call everyday icons. They're the icons that we've become familiar with, or we've engineered ourselves to navigate our three-dimensional, four-dimensional reality. But there is some malware in the system that is causing what I call rogue icons to appear on the screen. The question is, what purpose, if anything, do those rogue icons serve? And I'm not just talking about UFOs per se, but actually a range of paranormal phenomena, stuff that customarily we don't expect to see in our three-dimensional, four-dimensional lives, but which come through, you know, ghosts, cryptozoological creatures, you know, the sort of stuff that gets talked about at Skinwalker Ranch, all of it. So the if we stick with the sort of the software analogy, the malware analogy, and that these are rogue icons, are they some piece of software that is being fed into the system to accelerate our consciousness awakening? And if we again stay with the sort of symbolic aspect of UFOs and other rogue icon type signatures that appear on these screens, I think it's entirely possible that, you know, we are being confronted with something new. You know, there is a sort of, there is a new era about. And I mean, one of the more interesting conversations I had with people when I was researching my Bix essay, this consciousness, the survival of consciousness after death essay for the Bigelow Institute, was with an amazing medium called Suzanne Giesemann. Really interesting person. She used to be a US Navy commander, and she was an assistant to one of the to the Joint Chiefs of Staff at the time of 9/11. So, you know, she knows that world, the world of the military, but she's now a evidential medium in that she is routinely, or has been routinely, tested for her mediumistic abilities, but against evidence, so that you can sort of map it. And speaking to Suzanne, you know, Suzanne said to me, I go with your analogy of the computer screen. I go with your analogy of those icons. She said, but everything is a projection on that screen. A UFO is a projection, a spirit of a departed life is a projection. You and I are projections. We are all projections. We are all manifestations of what she called the one consciousness, the one
those crystallized individuals in the mind of God. I mean, whatever you want to call it, you know.
And everything is a projection on the screen. Mm-hmm. So put in those terms, what we will experience if we open our minds to it on the reality screen is an infinite number of projections.
Yeah.
There is nothing that you cannot experience on that screen if you look at it in that way. And I find that a very helpful analogy to go with, because again, it calls into question what we interpret as our reality. We think of it as physically real, solidly real, but actually it's a lot more malleable than we think it is. And I cannot understand why science hasn't gone down that road, because that road to me is the most interesting thing that mainstream science could get its teeth into. But for whatever reason, it has thus far, with some very notable exceptions, proven reluctant to go down that road.
Hear, hear. We exist on such a tiny slice of observation. You know, I mean, in terms of the electromagnetic spectrum and the visible light, that this tiny little sliver, and it just doesn't seem rational to use that little slither as a basis for saying, right, this is the status quo of reality, because we know that this is not the entire breadth of experience that can be seen. We're completely blind and ignorant to so much of it. So I agree with you that it just baffles me that the scientific community hasn't engaged in this in kind of like a more sophisticated manner. There has obviously been a little bit similar to the whole UFO issue, certainly programs that have looked into consciousness, non-locality, the idea of using it as an intelligence gathering method through remote viewing. You know, certainly something that, you know, a handful of intelligence communities and both Russia and America and probably other countries have taken seriously. But just like the UFO issue, when it comes to the potential propulsion and energy methods, this is something that's not really discussed in open academia. It's considered taboo and woo-woo. And I think that we're fast approaching a time where science is going to have to come to terms with a new understanding of reality. And I think that that's a good thing. And I think that it's going to be a bit disruptive, but there is a genuine sense of progress being made as we get into the realms of virtual reality and quantum mechanics and artificial intelligence. Obviously, there are worrying routes for these things as well as to where they might go, but it also does make me think that we're getting closer to piercing through that veil of materiality that we think dominates our world. And when we realize that truly things do seem to be some form of projection in all senses, and that we are coherent, sentient, aware systems that can influence this environment. I think that's the main thing for me, is that I truly believe we have this capability of being able to influence our material world in whatever way I don't truly understand. But when I change my mind about things, reality changes around me. And, you know, it might be micro changes. It's not like the whole world changes, but my kind of area of effect seems to change in terms of how people respond or the kind of situations that come into my life or how I might behave on any given day. These things alter reality. And that, I think, is a best kept secret of some very powerful people, I would imagine, that you have the ability to manifest and attract things into your life.
Yeah, absolutely. I share that view wholeheartedly. And I'm laughing about the word secret because, of course, you know, there has been quite a popular DVD and book,
The Secret,
The Secret, but which sort of in a pop way explores that very same issue. You know, one thing you said earlier back there is you know, science is beginning to engage in it. The to revert to what we were saying at the beginning of this discussion is that the military has always been much less reluctant to explore these areas. And, you know, it's always been interesting for me to compare those two bodies, the mainstream scientific body, you know, of academia as a whole, against another big sector, which is the military. And the way in which the military has been prepared to engage in unconventional activities in order to gain some kind of advantage has always been of interest to me. And of course, you know, America probably first and foremost, but also there's of course the Soviet Union and Russia, you should not forget as well. Yep. And increasingly the Chinese are interested in these areas and have been actually for a very long time. So in a sense, science doesn't have that much of an excuse for not engaging in this field, because to studiously ignore some of these phenomena that we've been talking about, it has to also say, well, the military's got it all wrong.
Yeah.
What you can do with the military is, of course, you can follow money trails. And, you know, one of the best examples, possibly overused, but it's true, is, you know, the remote viewing field. remote viewing was funded year on year for, I don't know, 15, 16 or so years, presumably because it achieved results. I mean, however profligate we think the military is, I don't think it's that stupid that it would year on year fund something for 15 or 16 years unless it had produced results.
Exactly.
And, you know, you and I know some of those players who were involved in that field, and I had worked with Ingo Swann on some of his books, you know, so, and I knew Ingo, and, you know, he was a fascinating character. He was the godfather of remote viewing, worked with Hal Puthoff and Russell Targ at SRI back in the early 70s. Just talking to Ingo convinced me that all of this was real. So for science to ignore all of that, it's having to say, you know, the military was just completely wasting its money. And of course, we know that that's not entirely true.
Well, we're getting into the dogma of science. You know, science in of itself isn't completely free of the types of kind of religious styles of belief that come into play when it becomes a reinforced status quo, a reinforced model or a theory about the way reality works. Material reductionism, Newtonian science, you know, these are the challenged principles that are now being looked at when you face to face with a UFO and realize that this is completely bending our understanding of physics. So there is a dogmatic perspective within science that's very akin to just kind of cult group mind think, you know, and people who have been celebrated and have their plaques on the wall for the good job they did in science maybe don't want to be contradicted and maybe don't want to have someone coming in with a new perspective and a new model. It's not always that way, but there are certainly people within the scientific institutions and especially in I'd say academia who would download their own principles onto the next student and the next student and the next student. And so there is a kind of a reinforced specific blueprint of what is rational, what is sensible, and what will you know, kind of get you a job, get you a career. And I think that that is a major issue when it comes to the next stage in scientific evolution, you know, because those people that uphold the status quo more often than not do not like to be challenged, and so I think that's withheld a lot of movement on very disruptive ideas with consciousness and even energy and propulsion.
Yeah, I think there are a number of elements in there, in that, you know, one is, of course, and we shouldn't forget that whole careers are built on, you know, scientists who have pursued and explored a particular strand of physics or chemistry or whatever that may be undermined by, or in fact would be completely undermined by a lot of what we are discussing here today. But to a degree, we're all going to have to face up to that.
Of course,
because I think you know, if the world is getting stranger, and it appears to be, sooner or later, it's going to impact all of us. And we're all going to have to face up to a step change, a consciousness shift in the way we perceive reality. And, you know, those who hang on to a dogmatic outlook, I think, are going to be in for a huge shock.
They're going to have a rough ride. It's going to be a rough ride.
Yeah. I mean, it's taken me 20 years, possibly, maybe a bit longer, to challenge my belief systems to allow me to get to where I am today. And, you know, I'm quite cautious on this subject, but yet the evidence for me, the data, which predominantly is what I follow because I was trained to follow it, the data trail is overwhelmingly significant in that it points to something extraordinary happening and to phenomena such as UAP of an exotic nature that cannot be accounted for by conventional explanations. It's taken me 20 years to come to be comfortable with saying that. So hanging on to your dogmatic outlook in your ivory tower, wherever that is, and, you know, Canute, like King Canute for our non-UK listeners, being an early English king who tried to hold the waves back because he felt that he could. You know, having that dogmatic stand in the face of the evidence, I think it's going to come as a huge cultural shock, particularly in academia, but it'll come in other fields as well. We all need to be ready for this because we are being confronted with it. And for me, that's exciting. I know for you, it's exciting, but for other people, that's really scary. Yeah. And just, you know, human nature being what it is, I'm sure you have the same conversations down the pub or similar conversations that I do with friends of mine who just go, they stick their fingers in their ears and they don't want to know.
Yep.
This is too weird. It's too out there. That is human nature.
But
that's the way it is.
It's like you said, I think maybe things are just going to get weirder and weirder until it gets to a point where literally you cannot ignore the reality that's being faced with. And so perhaps we are moving towards a time not so in the distant future. Maybe that's even why the US government's deciding to discuss this in the first place. I mean, obviously there are narratives that have developed around this whole 2017 to present day addressing of the UFO issue, and it's not 100% how exactly the mechanisms within the background of government have clicked into place to allow this conversation to happen, even in the diluted sense that it is happening when compared with the potentials of the UFO subject in general. It's still a very interesting change in direction for the US government to be taking. They'd pretty much satisfactorily packed this away as a silly subject to not be taken seriously, and suddenly out of the blue, here we are with programs being set up and NASA being involved and, you know, the DOD and the ONI and Congress. And it just makes me think, well, maybe there's some people way in the background who are like, yeah, we need to get this out because we're heading towards this and we need to start getting people acclimated and ready. Otherwise it could be complete chaos.
I think there is something to that. You know, as you said, the fact that we have all of these bodies, Congress, through the Pentagon, through the intelligence community, through NASA and others. To the degree, actually, we should give credit to some academic institutions, Harvard, mm-hmm. for opening its doors these heretical ideas and questions.
And Stanford, to a degree, with Dr. Gary Nolan.
Stanford's been in there for a long, long time as well. So, but, you know, yes, I think there is a great deal of truth to people in the know, with a more enlightened mindset than most, going, this is too big. We can't hold it back, nor should we hold it back. It is not ours to hold back. Yes, of course, militarily, there is a technical aspect to it. And I have no doubt that there is there seems to be evidence for a sort of kind of UAP arms race to try to acquire those secrets. But, you know, if we accept a smidgen of what we've been talking about in the last hour and a half, that this is not an entirely physical phenomenon, what maybe the reason that these people want it out there is because they know that it is not just a nuts and bolts phenomenon. It is not just a technological issue. It is about a facet of us as human beings that is going to cast our entire reality, the human story into an entirely new light. And, you know, if there are those enlightened people out there, and I think there are because I meet them in all walks of life, even in, you know, shock horror, the military and intelligence community worlds, there comes a point you can't hold that back any longer. And I think, you know, people talk about disclosure. You know, we want disclosure. I'm sure you share this view. You know, disclosure is happening daily now. It's coming all the time. But with that disclosure, it's not going to come wrapped up in a tidy box with a ribbon on it that is just going to point to you know, a piece of technology that's going to get us to the stars, or is going to be able to get us to navigate alternate realities even. It is going to come with a plethora of stuff that is going to confront our worldviews, our, you know, the way we perceive existence in wonderful and alarming ways. It will be Pandora's box, not in a bad way. I mean, funnily enough, I think, you know, what you were talking about earlier about the way the mindset you have to condition yourself to positively when you go and confront the interface. You know, I think that we largely, when we open that box, we're going to see in it a reflection of ourselves.
Yeah.
And if you want positive stuff to come out of that box, it will. If you want to draw the negative stuff out of it because you want to perceive it or acquire it for warlike purposes, that's what you'll find there too. And, you know, this, I think this is what's coming. And it's going to be an interesting ride.
How much of a role do you feel disinformation plays within the UFO research community?
Well, I'm glad we're devoting a little bit of sort of possibly the end of the show to the question, because it is, I think it's something that we need to be acutely aware of. And going back to the beginning of our discussion about the 80s and the 90s, and before that, you know, the military intelligence community all over the world, not just in America, but here in the UK and also in Soviet Russia and Russia today, have used the UFO phenomenon to hide stuff behind. It's incredibly convenient to do that. I'm reading quite an interesting book at the moment called Mirage Men. I don't know whether you've read it. There's also,
I haven't read it, but I've watched the documentary. Yeah.
And it's it details, you know, quite a lot of that activity. But you know, as an ordinary reporter for a, you know, a pretty sort of nuts and bolts trade magazine that James Defence Weekly was, I found myself coming up against disinformation at all levels in the course of my career. There was a, you know, a classic, an absolute classic, was when I went to visit the Skunk Works in 1996. And I interviewed Jack Gordon, the CEO of the Skunk Works. We talked about that earlier. And on my way out of the building under heavy escort, I passed by a sort of org map that shows a linear progression of all the Skunk Works aircraft stemming from an aircraft called the XP-80 in 1944-45, and right up through to then what was the meant to be, or the aircraft that I knew that should be at the top of the list, which was something called Dark Star, which was a UAV that failed. But it wasn't at the top of the list. There was something called Astra on the top of the list. And it looked pokey and pointy and purposeful. And I knew enough about Skunk Works and about aerospace to know that there is no such thing out there called Astra. And I called this out to my escort on the way as we passed out of the entrance hall. And rather, like a rather annoying sort of kid, I go, "What's Astra? What's Astra? What's Astra?" And I'm literally sort of given the bums rush out of the building. And like that persistent annoying kid, even when I get back to the UK, I'm emailing. What, did we have email in those days? Probably not. Anyway, I'm faxing them going, "What's Astra? What's Astra?" And they come up with this ludicrous explanation for what Astra is, which is that it was an airliner project that Lockheed studied in the 1970s, which got cancelled. Well, what was it doing at the top of your org chart past the YF-22 and Dark Star? No answer, you know, like end of conversation, bye. and I think about this, I write the story up in JDW, but with a sort of rather guarded tone. And it was only many years later, I mean, literally, like, I don't know, 2 or 3 years ago, I'm looking back over my, I keep all my diaries. I'm looking back over my diaries and I look at when I went to make that visit to the Skunk Works. And guess what? It was April the 1st. It was April Fool's Day. So here is the intelligence community. I've no doubt.
Oh my God.
Yeah. Going, wouldn't it be handy for Cook, who's doing this piece on Black world business trends, to be confronted with an org chart that shows something called Astra? Because we know he's been interested in this Aurora bird that, you know, James has been writing about for a while. And let's give him a bit of a pointer, a bit of a clue to all of that. Except, of course, was it or wasn't it? And that's the beauty of disinformation.
In order for
disinformation to work, there has to be at least a little bit of truth in there. And to divert momentarily into a topic of the day, was it last week or the week before we had the Calvine UFO picture?
Yes, that appears, very interesting situation.
Yeah, based on some very solid work by David Clark, whom I know. We've met and we've corresponded. He's a very diligent researcher. And I mean, you may want to tell the story, Jay, because you're more on it than I am. But, you know, in essence, it was the discovery of the original photograph, supposedly, of a UFO that appeared over Calvine in Scotland, the middle of Scotland, in Perthshire. And it's photographed by two poachers, supposedly. There's an accompanying aircraft with this diamond-shaped UFO that looks like a Harrier, but it could be maybe some other aircraft type. And this is huge news. It's massive news across the whole, Twitter sphere and social media, et cetera, et cetera. But I think it's actually much more interesting than it appears.
So, well, this is funny because we were talking earlier on about how, the UK and the MOD has been extremely quiet about the UFO subject all the way through the American government over the last few years being more vocal. So maybe this will start pushing the meter a little bit closer towards home, because this is obviously, you know, something that happened that was shot down by our Ministry of Defense. And so it makes me very curious. Obviously, the guy that brought out the image, or at least kept the image, was a retired RAF official. I think his name was Craig Lindsay. And what made me laugh is that he'd kept that photo in his desk between the pages of a book titled Great Aircraft of the World, which I just thought was a brilliant little, very, very cheeky little nod towards what he was up to. So I think it's fantastic that the image has come out. There's been a lot of debate about what it really is. Obviously, you've got the skeptics saying that it could be a rock in a pond or a mountain coming out of the clouds. I personally feel that these are really far-reaching speculations, but I don't want to say that it's an alien spacecraft. It's a diamond in the sky with a jump jet banking around it. And I do think that there is some form of craft in the air in this image. That's what I personally do believe. I just don't know what it is, whether it's an experimental aircraft, whether it's a UFO. What do you think about it, Nick?
Okay, so let's just look at when the photograph was purportedly taken. It was 1990. I believe it was taken on August the 4th. 2 days earlier, Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait. Now, I don't believe that that is not insignificant. In other words, I believe it is significant. And for the following reason, the discussion, as I've read it recently, and actually back in the day when this surfaced as an issue, because we perhaps should explain that a photocopy of this picture had appeared in a UK MOD document, a report on UFOs, and it had been touted by Nick Pope and others as having been blown up into a poster. This is the photocopy, and shoved on the wall of DI-55, anyway, the Defense Intelligence Secretariat that was given over to the study of UFOs, populated, I think, by two people or thereabouts. So this picture had gained, you know, some attention, and the fact that it was billed by the MOD, those in the know, as being a really kosher, genuine, you know, the most kosher, genuine picture of a UFO that they had probably ever come across, you know, gave it some real importance. But, you know, if we go back to the discussion at the time, it was August the 4th, 1990, 2 days earlier, Saddam Hussein had invaded Kuwait. The two poachers, supposedly, neither of whom, as far as I'm aware, have come forward, submitted the photographs to the Scottish Daily Record, I think it was. And the Scottish Daily Record elected not to publish any of them, but handed them into the MOD, who then confiscated them. The narrative then goes, of course, they touch base with their American counterparts, who supposedly go ballistic for reasons they don't entirely explain, but the MOD official, the UK MOD officials, take that to mean that it may have shown some secret American technology. Okay, all well and good. Now let's look at the vehicle itself, diamond-shaped. And a lot of people talk about Aurora in the same breath as this picture. You know, was this Aurora, this diamond-shaped vehicle, being buzzed by a Harrier or a Hunter or whatever it was? If you go with the story of the poachers, they say that they watched it for some time, and this is what they had debriefed to the MOD officials as well. This thing had sort of been hovering static in front of them for a while. It made no noise. And then in the end, it shot straight up, disappeared, you know, typical UFO sightings report. But still we get this Aurora association with it. So that makes me think and wonder, because as we discussed at the beginning of all of this earlier, whatever Aurora was or wasn't, and again, no pictures ever came, have ever appeared definitively showing that aircraft. Whatever Aurora was or wasn't, it was an aircraft powered by a relatively conventional engine and working on the basis of aerodynamics. So how these two things can be compared, a thing that hovers and goes straight up, which points to no known technology, and Aurora, which operates pretty much like a conventional aircraft, except it is pretty exotic, is significant, I think. When I was aerospace editor at Jane's, we covered the Aurora story in some depth. In fact, I have to give due credit to my colleague, Bill Sweetman, again at the time. Bill is now gone off to join the aerospace industry. So he's a great guy, and he really knows his stuff. Bill, one of the stories we covered at JDW in, I think it was in 1992, was the eye testimony of a North Sea oil worker and trained Royal Observer Corps observer, a guy called Chris Gibson, who on his oil platform in the North Sea looked up and saw a triangular shaped aircraft being escorted by what he thought were, I think it was three or four F-111s, a swing wing aircraft operated by the Americans out of Lakenheath, I guess, in Suffolk. In the UK, and being tanked by a tanker. Being a Royal Observer Corps observer, Chris Gibson should have known what he was seeing. And he swore that this was nothing he'd ever seen before. Hands the report off to Bill Sweetman. We cover the story in Jane's Defence Weekly, and the Aurora story is off and running. We cover the story some more, and bit by bit, reports of the aircraft, Aurora, this Mark 5 to 8 hypersonic high-flying spy plane to replace the SR-71, is reported operating out of RAF Macrahanish in the West Scottish Highlands. It's actually on the Mull of Kintyre. So suddenly we have 2 days after Saddam Hussein invades Kuwait, a UFO report popping up linked to the Aurora story. That's not suspicious. Well, here's what, I'm not saying this happened, but if I were a disinformation guru, here's what I would be up to. So Aurora is real. I think there's enough evidence to justify the fact that something was built. Just before he retired from the US Air Force as head of research and development, a guy called General George Molnar gave me an interview. And the topic of conversation, let me think, when was this? This was in 1998, I think. The topic of conversation, for the record, was black programs. That's what I came to the Pentagon to talk to him about. And we had a really good discussion, a long discussion. The subject of Aurora comes up. And I say, come on, General, it's your last day in office. You can tell me, is Aurora real? He didn't say, but he gave enough hints to say that between the retirement of the SR-71, which was around about that time, 1990, and the emergence of a new generation of digital spy satellites that gave real-time data, or that would give real-time data to people on the ground, there was a gap. There was a hole in the intelligence picture and it needed to be filled. And Aurora, not that General Molnar said this, but the evidence spoke to it. Aurora filled that gap, but it was expensive. And therefore, having served its purpose through the development of a number of what they called in the trade operational prototypes, it was then taken out of service. Having filled that gap, guess when that gap was? That gap was during the Saddam Hussein's invasion of Kuwait, 1990-1991. So if I were a disinformation guru, knowing that Aurora was operating out of RAF Macrahanish and that it was going to be appearing over Scotland rather inconveniently during that mammoth intelligence buildup of what was happening over Kuwait and Iraq in August 1990, what would I do? I would put out some really confusing information about UAP, UFOs, even if I knew that it wasn't going to come out at the time, because sure as hell it was going to come out later. And I think, therefore, with Calvine, whilst there may be something genuine there, for me, there's something not right about it. There is something really not right about that picture. The fact that we've got a couple of poachers who haven't come forward, there's the odd nature of the Daily Record not having run the story, but having handed the pictures to the MOD. That's kind of curious. But I think, you know, oh, and then, of course, here's what probably happened afterwards, which is that genuinely the people in DI 55 get these photographs, come to them from the Daily Record, and they go, what's this? We've got to investigate it. Touch base with their American colleagues. Aurora was such a compartmentalized sap in that it was so restricted information-wise that these guys then become prone to a phenomenon known as blowback, which I'm sure you know in the intelligence world is when you put a bit of disinformation out there or a bit of information out there, it swirls around in the world of intelligence and counterintelligence and eventually comes back to you as something sort of quasi-recognizable, but not really, from how you originally put it out. So I think this thing came back to British intelligence. They don't know what it is. They put it to the Americans. The Americans don't know what it is either at the level that DI-55 was talking to. But suddenly someone goes, holy shit, this is all about Aurora. So we're going to make a sort of, you know, big fuss about it. And I think part of that fuss was genuine by people who got spooked that the Aurora story might come out. But I think also part of it was just flammed up by people who genuinely thought that they'd tripped up over some top secret piece of American technology. Well, it was, but I don't think the technology that we're talking about or the real story is held in that diamond-shaped UFO. I think that was cover for what was really going on with an Aurora basing in and out of RAF Macrahanish. And that would have been intensely secret.
Yeah, see, this is why it's good to get your opinion on this with your background knowledge and your expertise. And that's a very interesting way of looking at it that I think is going to give people some food for thought. I know you've got to head off at 5:30. So we might as well look at wrapping this up now, Nick. But we've really traversed some interesting terrain over this conversation. We've gone from, and this is what I appreciate about you, is that you've got the analytical mind, but you've also got that openness to, you know, dive into the esoteric nature of this phenomenon, because this is absolutely a part of the conversation. So you're a great representation of, you know, a sensible mind that's looking at both aspects of this issue and trying to take it seriously. So really appreciate you coming on, Nick, as always. It's just a great pleasure to talk to you. And next time, I'm sure we'll have some more interesting things to discuss.
Well, thanks for having me as ever. And I've enjoyed the chat as ever. And look forward to the next time.